Welcome to our second podcast on making innovation happen here at London Business School. My name is Jessica Spungin. I am an adjunct professor of strategy as well as teaching on strategic innovation here at the school. My guests here today continue to be Gary Dushnitsky, the associate professor of strategy and entrepreneurship, who researches on corporate venturing and innovation, and of course, Alessandro Hatami, the COO of the Digital Bank and Head of Innovation for Lloyds, who has in the last few years set up on his own and is running an organization called Pacemakers, who specializes in bringing innovation into large organizations and working with small startups to make that happen. Thank you again for your time and coming in. We had an interesting conversation in our first podcast about the challenge of being in a big organization and what it means. And Alessandro, I know, has a point of view on the pendulum and how it's swinging from it all being about, you know, young startup type economy into people looking for more expertise.
Well, I think if for those of you who are old enough to remember the dot-com crisis and the dot-com crash, they call it crisis, of the year 2000, it was driven by these people going around saying that the future of the internet is not about making money, but is about eyeballs. Now, all of the companies that said that are now bust. The ones that were focusing on bottom line are called Amazon and the likes, and they're still around. So the same is happening, I think, in the second wave of innovation that is driven by mobile mobility and the ability to generate and to analyze data that we're seeing today. There was a big impetus, if you want, in 2014 onwards with people outside the incumbents being the main drivers of innovation. But these are finally realizing that maybe there is a bigger opportunity for innovation by actually not only being the hipster innovators, but also working with existing environments, because they will give you the ability to scale and to become larger a lot faster than trying to do it on your own. So I think there's a pendulum is shifting back because corporates are becoming more important in the innovation process.
And Gary, I know your research and a lot of the work that you do with startups is, you know, reinforces that point.
Exactly. And so I think that when I started off, I did a lot of work, and again, influenced by the dot-com bubble in the period preceding that, where you see a lot of small companies and a lot of large companies in the way that they try to interact. And I have some learnings I'll be happy to share. But if I'm looking at the current days, one of the biggest things these days, even among startups, is less emphasis on startups. They've matured. We're now talking about scale-ups. Yeah. And the moment you start talking about the scale-ups, the moment is you realize that those established corporations, they actually cracked the code on quite a few of these scale-up issues. And that further reinforces the opportunities for collaboration between the younger players and the more industry-established firms.
But this isn't a new phenomenon. If you look back at J&J and Microsoft, you know, 20, 30 years ago, their entire growth strategy was based on let's just wait for someone to develop something and they will acquire them. And it's a series of acquisitions for growth. So what makes today's external sourcing of ideas different from how that used to be?
It's not that different. If you think about the genesis of Microsoft, for those of you who remember MS-DOS, it was shipped with IBM computers. So that collaborating with a big company did help Microsoft become who Microsoft is today. So I think what's happening right now, there's an awareness within the startup world that the large companies are not necessarily your worst enemy. They're potentially your friends that enable you to create and scale up in the way you need to do. From the corporate side, they're saying that, look, we're not designed to be as innovative as some of these early stage companies are. Why don't we work with them to actually reposition ourselves in a way that is more attuned to what the market is asking from us? So there's this perception really that collaboration is actually more interesting than trying to fight each other.
Trying to fight each other? And why collaboration? Why not just acquire? Is there a difference between the two?
Sure. So I think that is probably where the secret comes around. We all understand that there need to be some sort of collaboration. And the question becomes, what is the strategy or what is the mechanism by which this takes place? And I think there's a great leap in terms of sophistication and development of tools that allow you to do that. Acquisition is great if you don't mind paying 110% to get 100% of the IP. And you already understand the economics associated with that. One of the things that we start seeing these days is these clever ways that achieve two goals. The first one is engagement. maybe these guys are not even interested in selling to begin with. And you can imagine a lot of small but interesting companies that would not sell even if you make that offer to them. The second one is on a corporate side. How do you protect your economics? How do you deliver on the impact you need to get without overpaying what you need to pay? And M&A can be very important, but also is associated with a certain ticket size and a certain implication to your own P&L. Other formats might try to optimize that ratio between what you get and what you pay for it.
I think M&A can work well, not always, because one of the challenges that you have is obviously the price that you have to pay, firstly. Secondly, there's an element of inflexibility. If you made a mistake in choosing a specific company, then you're stuck with it because you've spent a lot of money for that. And third is, how do you make sure that this company doesn't go obsolete? Because you bought this company, you think you have an IP, the IP deteriorates in time, and you end up with these very smart people that actually don't want to be a big part of a big corporate, because otherwise they would have gone to a big corporate. And how do you retain them? And how do you change your culture so that these people don't feel marginalized and they're not fought by the rest of the organization as if they were germs that with antibodies internally have to destroy? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big challenge of corporate acquisition is that. A good example of this, sometimes you see companies buying early stage firms that have proven themselves and keep them relatively insulated and isolated from the rest of the group. With the vision of once they've proven their model, then we make them become mainstream. There's a few examples of this having done, but there's very few examples of it actually having worked. So
it's
just
tough.
Food for thought.
So it's very interesting because we kind of skipped a step, which is why are they doing this, right? Why is this collaboration so important to the corporates? Why are they going outside their organization to source things?
Well, I think we need to be careful about the concept of collaboration. Collaboration has many different forms. So there's the partnering of collaboration. There's the acquisition of collaboration. There's a joint development of collaboration. They're all collaboration.
Yeah.
And the acquisition is not just the only methodology. The reason large corporates are thinking about partnering is that they're realizing, because they've done the evolutionary innovation in their organization, that some of the skills that you need to do the revolutionary innovation is not within their core capabilities. So by partnering with a third party, they can deliver things through skills that they don't currently own. Also, if they make a mistake and that innovation that they were thinking was right in reality is wrong, they haven't invested that much by partnering. They haven't built the vision. They've worked with a company and they've launched the product, brought it in work. You end up the commercial relationship at that point. So I think it gives you much more flexibility than the build in-house, which is the big driver to this revolution that we're seeing.
So it's about flexibility. It's about accessing stuff that you might not see inside your own organization.
Correct. And so I think that there's these moving parts basically manifest themselves in multiple ways. One additional way in which you can potentially think about it is, what do we achieve by going outside? Well, even the largest organization out there would not say that they employ more than 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people with an engineering degree, with a knowledge expertise within that domain. Oftentimes, there are 10 million, 30 million people out there in the world who have been trained within that discipline. How do we make sure that we don't shut ourselves out to only focus on what those 10,000 people are saying? How do we make sure that we reach out and listen to the others?
Right.
Why would we want to do that? Well, on the most basic level, maybe some of them are cheaper to engage with. One of the interesting things we have here in Europe is a whole cadre of highly talented engineers that have now reached retirement. They're not looking for the next paid job, but they might actually be able to contribute from their knowledge, their expertise, on a one-off basis. This is where you need a more arm's-length way of engaging and connecting with them. You can think about other populations where these kind of more arm's-length relationship might work out. So this is on the economic side, and we can kind of play out that as well. Then on the revolutionary side, you might actually, by leveraging open innovation, by reaching out beyond corporate boundaries, reach out to talent you're not set up to employ internally. And in doing so, you might be exposed to technologies or business models that you have not seen. And so a business model that would have been laughed out of a conference room within an organization might actually percolate and incubate externally. And by reaching outside, you can see that. And you know what? If you see one of these experiments, maybe you don't think much of it. But if you keep bouncing against 17, 27, 58 different people experimenting with a different business model, there's a learning in there for you.
Right. So on the one hand, it's about opening your mind and opening the access. You know, this is the freelancing economy in some ways. But it's also about opening your perspective to the fact that somebody might come up with something better. How do you find those things, right? I mean, is there any system that you've seen inside organizations that they're really good at filtering the millions of people and millions of ideas out there to select which one to go for? Alessandro, I know you spend most of your time doing this.
That's a great question. That's what we do at Pacemakers. I think the important first step in that is understanding exactly what you want to achieve. So they have a vision of where you want to go. Secondly, to choose the partner, don't choose the partner that comes your way. Don't use a serendipitous methodology. Don't just work with company X because you read an article in Wired magazine or you went to Money 2020 or your cousin told you these guys are really good. But do a whole of market perspective and see who is there that can deliver the thing that you want. And you may be surprised. It could be IBM and Accenture and the big guys at the end. But then it may be also the Indian startup with 4 employees at the other end. And you need to find out who's the right one for you. Then once you've found this company, find the one that is best fit for your own needs. And your own needs are not just technical. So technical is not just the one dimension. It's also, do they get along with my risk people? Am I able to invest in a company that one of my competitors is investing in? Do I want to work with a company that is based in this part of the world that I cannot work with, et cetera, et cetera. So whole of market, you bring it down to the 10 that you can work with, and then you start doing pilots with them and you test outcomes. And the one that works best, you then build your proposition. And at some point, you may decide you want to buy them, but it's not your first move.
Right. Which, by the way, brings us, it reminds me of something Julian Birkinshaw, one of our colleagues here, would talk about, which is just get on and do something. Don't just analyze and analyze and analyze. Start doing stuff. But let me come back to you and this concept of the engineers.
How do you find them?
How do you find them? I mean, I know there have been companies who've done open source competition. A Lego is a good example where they put out there, you know, come up with a great idea, become a Lego expert or whatever it is. But there are lots of companies who've done this.
So the world is fascinating, and this is a topic that I've been studying and researching and working with for longer than I care to admit. How do you find those external parties? Well, one of the things that we definitely see, this is the time and age of where corporate venturing has mushroomed yet again. Many companies set up vehicles to explicitly touch startups, and that can be a full-on corporate venture capital unit that serves as a venture capital firm, that can be corporate accelerator that is meant not necessarily to touch companies, be that startups or even more mature, but touch innovative people, individuals, through the corporate accelerator. And there are various ways and forms in between. There are also a lot of entities that have developed over the last 10, 15 years that help with making this matching, because this coming together is actually a very difficult process to be. Mm-hmm. At the simplest level, and I'm sure, Alessandro, you can attest to that, who manages the IP that gets us together? Sometimes you actually need that independent third party, on the one hand, to vet that this is an IP worth looking at, and on the other hand, to facilitate and frankly shield the large corporations from the issues associated with something like that. Some of these specialists are very good at understanding what happens in the vertical. Others are very good at understanding what happens in the geography. And I think one of the most exciting things that I have seen over the last 10, 15 years is really the maturity of those strategies by large corporations and those other players that facilitate that.
Right.
And this is one of the most exciting things that is happening.
So the agencies to facilitate it, their platforms, give me some examples of the kinds of things we're talking about here.
So you have many. In fact, one that we have started here at London Business School as a summer project by a few people, Simon Schneider and Janine McCambi, who have basically recognized that at a day and age where homeland security doesn't mean big missiles and big submarines, it means cybersecurity and technological solution. What they've done is they've reached out to many different players in the security industry, and they told them, we will find those solutions for you. You are very good at finding somebody internally to build up an intercontinental missile. But how do you protect yourself against this hacker? They started this off as a competition here at London Business School, some 12 years ago. And what they were able to do was basically map out and understand what is the landscape of software-based, cyber-based security companies. And they built it into an organization that was called OmniCompete. OmniCompete was then acquired by Innocentive, which basically runs a platform that matches firms with needs for innovation with individuals that facilitate innovation.
It's a bit like TaskRabbit for a specific functional skill or need inside a company.
I like to call it dating website for science, not for scientists.
Very good. Alessandro, you spend all your time doing this stuff.
I totally agree with what Gary is saying. I think you need to be cautious who your partner is. Because on one side, you want to make sure that there's no incentive for them to work with company X and you're being matched with the company that is absolutely right for you. Mm-hmm. The analogy that I like to use is that of the executive search firm. So you as a business may need a CFO. So when you go to speak to a big search firm, the first question this company, the search firm will ask you is, who are you and what do you do? So if you're an investment bank or a retailer, the CFO is called CFO, but they have very, very different roles. So understanding that is a fundamental thing. And then what they do is that they go to market with your requirements and they look through all the community that they know, but they also go beyond their community. They do a search that is specific to your requirements and your needs. You wouldn't want them to have a database of really good CFOs that you can work with.
Right.
You want one that is exactly right.
So it's more like a matchmaking service than a dating.
Matchmaking has an issue with it because matchmaking in reality, both parties pay to be part of the match.
Okay.
You want only one party to pay and you want the corporate to pay because the corporate wants to know that the advice you're getting is completely arm's length and it's completely impartial. If you are working with somebody that says you should work with this company because I've invested in it, yes, from one side you'd say, well, it's a really good thing because they invested in it. Or you could say, well, they're telling me to work with it because they've invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be comfortable that that is the right choice.
The impartiality of it.
Yes.
Okay, so let's say you've done your search, you've looked on your platform, you've employed a company to do the market research for you, whatever it is, you found these experiments. How do you manage the interface between you and the external provider to get the best out of it?
So again, it all depends on what you're trying to get out of it. You might be interested in having this innovative individual to come on board. You might actually need a company that already has a solution, maybe also already has a product in the market. Or you might actually be looking for that acquisition target because you really need to deploy that in a time and in a scale that requires you to have something more mature. The way in which you search for that counterparty and then the way in which you interface with that party is really a function of where you need it along the life cycle.
But what you're describing is not that different from managing a portfolio of strategic options in the olden days, but they were all inside the company. You're just tailoring how you manage it, and it's about option management.
So it is about option management. I think where it's interesting is that if in the past you had most of the flow coming from a certain type of people with a certain type of expectation and certain type of ROI, what you have these days is way more complicated because the time horizons, the expectations of reward, the expectation on other dimensions changes a great deal. If you're looking at in the fast-moving consumer goods space, some of the biggest beverage companies realized that they actually don't want to acquire all of these new age beverages and solution. Why? Because so much of what was sold was not just about the flavor or the packaging, it was the story.
Seed lip
and so on and so forth, all the way from Ben and Jerry's to Honesty, right, and so on and so forth. You buy that, by definition, it might lose the spark that made it unique. Right. And so this is where you really need to kind of think about what is the nature of engagement as a function of what is the unique setting and needs both of yourself and your partners.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree completely. I think what you need is a smart layer in between you and the startup. I think ultimately a corporate partners with an early stage company because they want to do something profitable, either short term or in the long term. So in the long term, we want to associate this brand because ultimately creates retention and retention creates revenue streams in the future that I care about. The smaller company wants to work with the big corporate because it accelerates the pace in which they generate the valuation that they hope to achieve from the investment of their time and their skills, et cetera, that they built. So these types of organization oftentimes speak in tongues that are not the same, and they have objectives that need to be aligned. So somebody in the middle of these two things that I call the bridge is a fundamental role. And that role is somebody that is both understands how the corporates operate and what drives them and how a startup operates. So to explain to the startup, as you were saying, Gary, that the compliance dimension can kill you and learning it, and it's not a boring thing that you have to deal with after you've built your product, is a fundamental level of input that you can generate. And the same goes for the large corporate. Explain to the large corporate, if you take 9 months, 12 months, 18 months to pay for the pilot and engage with the pilot of this company may not be around by that time. So the ability to respond in the right time frame is going to be fundamental in you being able to work with this other organization. Slowly, I think, as large corporates and startups start working with each other, this language will be developed and the large companies will be able to understand how to engage with the smaller firms. But right now, there is a need for a cushioning, an element in between that connects these two companies and translates what one needs and has with the other one.
And do companies that do this really well on a serial, it's a bit like, again, I come back to M&A, but I agree this is not all about M&A. But companies who did serial M&A built muscle in doing it. What you're saying is to collaborate with a wide variety of businesses at different stages or even individuals at different stages of evolution and plug them into your organization requires you to build muscle in being able to manage different interfaces which will have different process requirements, different governance requirements, different incentive programs. And that is actually unbelievably complex. And is there an organization who's done it really well? Or are most people using other organizations to sort of bridge the expertise, the platform type thing to do that for them?
So the one thing, and I think the muscle analogy is a brilliant analogy, because I think what it suggests is that there are learnings and there are ways of improving and there are ways of kind of bringing those two parties together. I like to give the example of the client list. Who should own the client list? The large established corporation? The startup. Just by having that conversation, you can really get a lot of traction going on. Now, the interesting thing about it is that some companies, some platforms have been very good at managing these, building those muscle tissue, if you wish. The one thing, and if you allow me to stay with this analogy, is that the muscle tissue you need if you're aiming at being a cyclist is very different than the one that you develop if you're planning to being a tennis player. Mm. And so what you want to do is in looking at those who can help you with this process, recognize not only the expertise, but to what extent is their expertise relevant to what you're about to do. Mm. Oftentimes the conversation I have are with companies that have done a great job studying what other successful firms have done in collaboration. Only problem is they've done it in a sector that has very little bearing to the way they conduct their business. And so what you want to make sure of is that they get this learning from somebody who is very well experienced within the setting or the sector that they are playing in.
I think I can use a lot of historical analogies of the Roman Empire and so on and so forth, but I'm not going to do that.
Coming from Rome, as you
coming
do.
From Rome, that would make sense. But I think ultimately what you need to do is it's a triangular relationship. The relationship is the existing incumbent, the challenger, the customer, and these things need to be engaging. So the two guys come together, the challenger and the incumbent come together because they want to serve the customer. And you have to, that has to be part of the equation at all times. So companies that want to engage have to create this digital enabler in the middle of these three that understands all three and is able to translate the needs in a way that is productive and is functionally viable for all three parties. And that's a set of skills that you can develop. The muscles that we were talking about earlier are fundamental in delivering that. Now, what does that require? That requires an understanding of the needs of the early stage firm, understanding of the needs of the big guy, understanding of what the client actually wants, because sometimes corporates forget about this. They think that they sell products. They don't sell products. They sell something that the client wants. And sometimes it's not a product. Sometimes it's an outcome from the product. And the challengers oftentimes see this better, but they don't have access to the millions of customers that the large corporate does. So understanding each other's languages in a way is a role of somebody in between that can be within the corporate. It can be an external organization. And this has to be able to engage these three parties in a way that generates valuable, viable, and sustainable value. And that's at the core of success.
So it's very interesting. So we've been talking, you know, Gary, you're talking about different kinds of muscle. You're talking about the mediation role. One of the problems that big corporations face, however, is that the nature of the organization is it's already complex in many cases. They have multiple business units, multiple different decisions that they've made about where they're going to play, how they're going to deliver, who they're going to serve. If you add into the mix five or six different business models and five or six different interfaces, you know, even if you tried to draw the lines and boxes, it would be horrific. And then if you said, you know what, let's forget about the lines and boxes. Let's talk about how the interface works and whether this is process or a norm or a behavior or a value. How do you connect these organizations? What is the style and culture and behaviors that means you have a functioning organization that is not too complex, right? And I would define complexity as being difficult to get things done around here.
Well, the way we look at it, we think about three stages of innovation. I think the first stage is kind of an adapt stage. And in that stage, you just look at your existing processes and try to make them slightly better. You digitize them or whatever it is. And that is something that is done best in-house. Then there's the evolve phase. And we're saying, okay, I've created these capabilities internally, this talent that I've built, the IT talent, commercial, marketing, et cetera, that I've built in doing the adjacencies. I can now start creating these new things, these new products, and I'm adapting myself to the new world. And then once you've done this and you're creating products that are entirely driven by these new assets, you can think about transform. You can think about the Netflix moment with Blockbuster, the completely revolutionary product that actually takes you to the next dimension. These stages need to be managed by this innovation entity internally, which in the initial phase, it looks at generating short-term value. In the second phase, it's almost an umbrella that tests different things within the complete view of the rest of the organization, but brings them out and engages them at the right time, at the right point, with different stakeholders within the organization to make sure that this is a successful organization. Mm-hmm. So this entity, this innovation hub, needs to understand how the mothership works and who to speak in legal to make sure that this product is not killed by legal, and who is the IT person that will support you in this division, but also is able to understand what are the five startups that can do stuff for me that I can actually viably, credibly test new things that I can then generate these new propositions with that I then sell to the rest of the organization. So in a way, it's a very multi-skilled, multi-talented individual or set of individuals in the organization that actually are able to create an umbrella that shields the rest of these startups from the stuff coming up to them from above.
Right.
And actually allows these startups to be incubated in a relatively safe environment, but not necessarily a safe environment that is not Darwinistic. So if you're not good, you should be eliminated. But if you're good, you should be surprised. So that equation, that balance is tricky. And that's why the innovation enabler is a fundamental role in a big organization.
So I want to take all that because I think this is a keen insight, and I maybe want to add one layer that I've observed in the last couple of years. So I think the first point, Alessandro, keep me honest over here, what you're saying is that in putting an effort to connect with externals, you should not lose sight that value is actually delivered in also having the connections internally.
Absolutely.
For you to scale is for you to integrate. And for you to integrate, don't just set people out on a mission to create all these external relationships without allowing them, for your organization, to take advantage of it. And that means a lot of connectivity internally. Already, that carries some derivatives in terms of who do you want to hire, what skill set, what networks, what knowledge do they bring in place. So I think this is a very important issue, and I, you know, fully agree with Alessandro on this point. I think one of the interesting things that is happening right now, increasingly in a world where many companies have learned that there's a value in adopting open innovation, is also realizing that when you reach out to these externals, you have your externals, your competitor has their externals. And so just resting on your laurel and thinking that, oh, I've engaged with externals, you also need to be mindful that in this highly saturated open innovation environment, that is another layer you want to be mindful of. How to manage that, how to manage collaboration amongst that. I think this is where some of the cutting edge thinking is taking place right now.
So I agree completely, Gary. But just one thing I'd like to add is that innovation is not just about working with startups. Innovation is about delivering something new. And sometimes that something new can be delivered with a large multinational that's been around for 30 years, not necessarily a startup in Shoreditch.
So I'd like to thank my two guests today, who have taken us through the landscape of how big corporates look outside their own organizations for innovation. Thank you, Gary, for coming along.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Alessandro.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening to our podcast. To find out more and become an expert on innovation, why don't you look at our website, www.london.edu, and check out all the other things that we have in terms of research and articles to support your learning.